With the state of today's economy, it is more important than ever to invest in products that last for years to come. As the seasons shift and get cooler, make sure your closet is stocked with durable layers that stand the test of time from American Giant. American Giant's clothes work harder and are wearable season after season. Their greatest hoodie ever made is made of the highest quality materials that are cut and sewn right here in the United States. So you're investing right back into your local community. Choosing American Giant means taking a stand for American manufacturing and hardworking Americans, something other mega corporations don't care about. From fleece to knit, all in a range of colors for versatile daily wear, American Giant delivers everyday pieces designed for everyday life. Feel the difference of quality made-to-last clothes from American Giant. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.
It's time to wake to sleep with Sleep Science Today, where we learn to sleep well with your host, Andrew Kolsky, on UK Health Radio.
Welcome to Sleep Science Today. I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky, and on this show, we talk all about sleep science, how you can get better sleep, and things that you probably didn't know about sleep that you should know. Our guest today is Dr. Linda Schachter. She is a sleep doctor and has been doing this for most of her career and has a lot of great information for us. So, Dr. Schachter, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Andrew.
So we have a lot of different topics that we're going to get into today, but before we even get into that, why don't you give us the benefit of telling us, how did you get into sleep medicine in the first place, and what's it like to practice sleep medicine?
So I started actually training as a respiratory intensive care specialist. So when I started doing my training, I thought, I want to be an intensive care specialist, and which means that you've got to do quite a lot of shift work. And after about 3 months of doing shift work, several of my friends actually approached me and said, please don't do intensive care. You are so grumpy. Your mood's terrible. And basically, please don't do intensive care medicine because you're so unpleasant to be around. And what I actually realized was my body clock couldn't shift between a day shift and a night shift, which you actually need to do quite regularly if you're doing intensive care medicine. So when I started looking at alternatives, I thought, well, I'll be a lung specialist. And while I was doing lung specialty training, they offered us to do extra training in sleep medicine, and so we could have dual specialty. But once I started doing sleep medicine and treating people who have sleep disorders, I love it. I absolutely love it, because people who don't sleep well and or who have poor quality sleep, and then you actually help them to sleep better, they think you're wonderful. And you really, it's one of the one areas of, I suppose there's a few areas in medicine where you change people's lives. But I truly change people's lives when they sleep better.
Right. Wow. Wonderful. So that's interesting. A sleep doctor who realized she doesn't do well with her own circadian rhythm in other work. So I can really appreciate that story. You know, it does raise one other question that I'm curious about. So you said you did, you know, special sleep work and all, but before you did that, when you just did your regular medical training, did you get any training in sleep at all?
No. So I've been a sleep doctor now for 25 years, and 25 years ago, sleep wasn't seen as important at all. If anything, you know, the whole mentality about us was we were stronger if we didn't sleep. I mean, it was like sleep is for the weak, and if we had things to do, you'd stay up late at night and then get up early in the morning, and it was seen as, you know, you were invincible, you know. So there was nobody understood the importance of a good night's sleep back then. And over the last 25 years, I mean, I'm based in Australia, but even now, the medical course in Australia, they get 1 day of training on sleep in the whole 5 years, which is just terrifying, considering every disorder, every medical disorder, everything that goes wrong with your body has an impact on your sleep, and your poor sleep has an impact on basically every part of your body itself.
Right, right. Wow. Yeah, that's, you know, one of the things that was really kind of shocking to me in the U.S. here is that, so I do behavioral sleep work, which is something that comes from the mental health side of our work. And in our schooling, whether you're a psychologist, a psychiatrist, a mental health counselor, whatever it may be, we don't get anything about sleep, really, just no information. And then the same thing with the medical doctors. It's just not part of their curriculum. So a lot of people have sleep disorders. They go see their primary care physician, which is, makes a lot of sense. And the extent of knowledge today is mostly just here's a prescription for a sleep aid or a sedative, and that's all they know. And there could be all sorts of underlying sleep disorders. So, you know, the fact that people are becoming more aware of sleep disorders really helps them get to the specialist to then help them get the help they need. Wow.
Absolutely. And, you know, as you know, if you do behavioral sleep, you know, sleeping aids may help in the short term, but they're not a long-term solution for any sleep disorder. You know, you need to be looking at your habits. You need to be looking at your mental health. You need to be looking at all these other things before you look at a long-term sleep aid like a sleeping tablet. They just don't work long-term.
Right. I'm 100% with you. And the good news is that many people are becoming aware of that, and they're realizing that they don't want to stay on these sleep aids if they've been on them for a while. And then that's why we do the behavioral part, and we're able to help them get off the sleep aids. But in terms of, you know, walk us through like a typical case where someone comes to you and they say, you know, doctor, I'm just having a horrible time sleeping. I go every night and I barely think I even close my eyes. And this has been going on for months and I don't know what to do. What types of things would happen when they come to a sleep doctor? How are you going to help figure out what's going on for them?
So first of all, we sit down and have a very intensive discussion pretty much about every aspect of the person's life, their medical history, what medication they're on, also finding out what started the problem. So did it happen acutely? Was there an event that sort of started the poor sleep, or how did it actually happen? And also what's actually causing the problem to continue. So even if this initial problem's gone away, anxiety, worry, or even sleep stress itself, so worrying about not sleeping, will actually make the problem worse even if the initial problem has gone away. So what we do is we sit down and we find out in quite a lot of depth about the problem, what's actually happening with their sleep. Can they fall asleep? Do they have problems falling asleep? Do they have problems staying asleep? Are they just waking during the night? Are they waking tired in the morning? So what's the actual problem? And then you want to know about their sleep habits. So what do they do to try and overcome these problems? And it's fairly intensive discussion. It's also about their social situation. It's about relationships. It's about anxiety, mental health issues. So that everything sort of accumulates in this 8 hours or 9 hours that you try and sleep at night. So if you're having problems, it often will present at night time with problems falling asleep, staying asleep. So we need to know all about all of that. And then what we've got to try and do and work out, you know, short term and then long term, how we need to approach these problems. Because if somebody's very distressed about their sleep problems, while behavioural things do help most people, they may not get over that initial hump to get somebody to sleep well initially, and then obviously we've got to work out the long-term solutions for what the problems actually are. So we go through all the behavioural issues, which what you do as well, and we'll mm-hmm. go through sleep habits, what people do before bed, what they eat, what they drink, all of those sort of things, and try and get them into better habits for better sleep, because what you do during the day often will affect how you sleep at night. The other thing that we do is we try and tell people a little bit about not worrying about their sleep, because as soon as you worry about not sleeping, you're not going to sleep. So sleep's one of the things, the harder you try and do it, the less likely you're going to be able to sleep. So what you've got to do is actually almost think of what's the worst thing that happens if you lie there all night. You're going to be a bit tired the next day. It's not great, and ideally you want to have a good night's sleep. So what we do is we go through, well, okay, if you don't sleep at night, you'll be a bit tired, but you'll cope. And then what you've got to try and do is get people to relax, to sort of downturn all of that alertness at night that tends to happen when they're anxious and worrying about not sleeping.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay. So really it's just a full evaluation of their entire day, what they're eating, their exercise, you know, everything about what they're doing. So, So I would assume in some of those cases though, you, through the interview and through the work that you're doing, you get clued in that maybe this person's got something else going on. Maybe we should look at sleep apnea as a possibility here. What types of things would clue you in to think about sleep apnea, and then what would you do about it?
So I gather that your listeners actually know what sleep apnea is, but sleep apnea is a condition that a lot of people have where you don't breathe properly at night. And not breathing properly at night affects the quality of your sleep, and so what happens is it causes you to have disturbed sleep and then waking tired. So what we would want to know if somebody presents and we think they might have sleep apnea, you want to know about snoring. Now, not everybody who has sleep apnea snores, but most people do. Mm-hmm. Sleep apnea, the terminology itself actually means to stop breathing during sleep. So people may actually stop breathing during sleep. And if your partner notices you stopping breathing, there's a high likelihood that you've got sleep apnea, even if it's only once. And or people may shallow breathe during sleep. So changes in breathing, so loud snoring, changes in breathing or stopping breathing overnight. People may wake overnight having problems breathing. So they may wake choking, short of breath, may wake with their heart racing, and that may happen. But they also may just wake in the morning feeling tired, unrefreshed. They may wake with a dry mouth, with a headache, or they may have daytime symptoms and they may be being tired, sleepy, fatigued, poor concentration during the day. So all of those things may give us a hint for the person may have sleep apnea. Then when we examine the patient, we will obviously, now a fair proportion of people who have sleep apnea are overweight or obese, but not everybody is. Probably about 20 to 30% of my patient load with sleep apnea are normal weight, have normal weight, so they're not overweight or obese. So the fact that somebody's not carrying weight shouldn't preclude that they may have sleep apnea. So there's all of these things that will give us, but we look at their airway to see if they can easily breathe through their nose, do they have problems breathing through their upper airway, is it crowded, and then obviously if they're carrying weight, where do you carry weight? If you carry weight on your neck or around your abdomen, you're more likely to have sleep apnea.
Wow, okay. So, you know, if, I'm just trying to figure out how to ask the question. Can you give us a better understanding between men and women when we talk about sleep apnea? Is there differences in age of onset or physical characteristics or purposes for onset, or is it all the same?
Men and women actually present quite differently with sleep apnea. So first of all, anybody at any age can have sleep apnea. So we'll start with that. So either gender, any age can have sleep apnea. In kids, often it's big tonsils or big adenoids, or it can be weight. So that's in kids. In adults, the prevalence or how often you have sleep apnea, it does tend to be a bit more common in men than women, but women still can get it. Now, as we go through menopause, as women go through menopause, our risk of sleep apnea increases. So in the postmenopausal period, so after menopause, the risk of having sleep apnea is equivalent in men and in women. And that's because some of the hormones that we have before we hit menopause are a bit protective of our upper airway. So prevalence can be across any age, a bit more common in women as we get older and we get into the postmenopausal period. Now, how women present, women actually present quite differently. I used to joke that, you know, men present with snoring and stopping breathing because their wives are awake and notice it. Women present with being tired because the men are asleep and just don't notice when the women stop breathing or snore. So, but women do snore, women do stop breathing. Those symptoms are similar. But women actually present a little bit more with being tired. So, you know, women do present differently, particularly in the postmenopausal period. They may present with being tired. They may present with poor, decreased mood. They can present, they can present with nightmares sometimes. So women actually can present quite differently. So it's important that if somebody presents with being tired, fatigued, or even sleepy during the day and no other cause is found, that they do think, well, maybe something's wrong with my sleep, and then maybe it's sleep apnea.
Fantastic, fantastic. So I want to follow up on that in a second, but first let me stop us for a quick commercial break, and then we'll be right back and continue our discussion about sleep apnea with Dr. Linda Schachter.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
The station that makes you feel good.
If you're having trouble sleeping and you need support, don't go it alone. Join us at our free online support group at sleepsupportgroup.com. Just put in your email address, sign up for the list, and you will be notified of all of our upcoming meetings. It's free, so why not try it out? Okay, welcome back to Sleep Science Today. I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky. We were just talking about sleep apnea and sleep apnea in women. So I just wanted to kind of make sure I got this straight. So women post-menopause can have sleep apnea and don't necessarily need to be carrying extra weight or any of the sort of stereotypical things that we hear about with sleep apnea. Did I get that right?
Absolutely.
Perfect, perfect. Okay. So let's talk about another common issue that I hear about from a lot of my female clients, and that is people who are sleeping, and they wake up in the middle of the night, and a lot of times it's equated with hot flashes. What's going on there, and what can they do about it?
So hot flashes are related to hormone changes in huge swings in hormone changes overnight. And so what tends to happen is obviously a hot flash. Now, 70% of hot flashes will wake somebody up in the middle of the night. So if you're having frequent hot flashes, you will wake frequently overnight. And it's not just wake up and then go back to sleep. It's with a lot of arousals. If you're having a hot flash, you often wake sweaty, unpleasant, you've got to get up, you know, change clothes, change bed clothes, whatever. So it's a frequent problem. And the other thing is that hot flashes can last, unfortunately, for 7 to 10 years. So these are not a little problem if you tend to get hot flashes at night and they disturb your sleep. Actually, I recently read a paper that some women get hot flashes up to 10 times a night. So, unfortunately, it can cause really major sleep disturbances. So there's actually, obviously, a few things that you can do to try and limit it. Number one is keeping your bedroom cool. So that may help. So ideally for all of us, we sleep better if our bedrooms are kept a little bit cool. Our body temperature needs to go down by about 1 degree overnight, and that's when our body temperature will sleep the best. So keeping your bedroom cool may be helpful. Now, obviously, overnight, if you're having 10 hot flashes or even a few hot flashes that wake you up, that's not going to be enough to reduce your hot flashes. There are some herbal things, herbal medications that may be helpful, number one. Mm-hmm. Number two, if they do get too intrusive, it may be worthwhile to talk to your doctor about, even for a short period of time, hormone replacement therapy may be helpful in reducing hot flashes. There also are other medications that reduce hot flashes overnight. So unfortunately, with something like that, especially if they're they're disturbing your sleep a lot, you may need medication or you may need hormone replacement therapy just to make sure you're getting a good night's sleep so you can cope with everything else that's going on at the time.
Right. Wow. Okay. So you mentioned some different herbal options for women with hot flashes. Anything in particular that people may want to go look up and learn more about?
Absolutely. So there's a couple of different things. So one, magnesium can sometimes be quite helpful. That's a natural muscle relaxant, stabilizes the cell membrane, so that might be helpful. GABA or GABA aminobutyric acid, which is another herbal thing that may also be helpful. Fenugreek Greek is another one. So there's a few different herbal medicines that may be quite helpful. There are a couple that also give are similar to estrogen, sort of herbal versions of estrogen that may also be helpful. And I'm sorry about that. I'd have to check those exactly before giving out information on that. But there are a couple of other ones that can be helpful as well.
Okay, fantastic. Just so we know there's some things that people could check into there that may be helpful for them if they're having trouble with hot flashes at night. Okay, so let me go back to one other thing that we were talking about in a little bit of a different way. So we were talking about sleep apnea. We were talking about how in some cases carrying extra weight can have an impact and cause or exacerbate sleep apnea. I know that you did some work and research with obesity and sleep. Are there other things that people who are carrying extra weight should be thinking about when it comes to sleep and impacts on their sleep?
Yes. So if you're carrying a little bit of weight, so basically what sleep apnea is you've got a genetic predisposition of a narrow upper airway usually, and then weight gain tips you over to having sleep apnea. Now, in some people, they can put on lots and lots of weight, it won't have an impact. Other people can only put on only a small amount of weight and can have an impact. So if you've got a problem with snoring, snoring is partial upper airway obstruction. So snoring gives you a guide that if you don't have sleep apnea yet, you may be on the way to it. So if you have a problem with snoring or sleep apnea and you're carrying weight, weight loss may be helpful. Now, so that's number one, and we can talk about the different ways of weight loss that may be helpful. And it seems to be that it doesn't really matter how you lose the weight. So it can be losing weight by regular exercise or diet. It can be losing weight by very low-calorie diet. It can be losing weight by surgery or even medication. So it doesn't actually matter how you lose the weight. Losing weight will help in most people. Now, we actually did a trial, scarily 15 years ago now, where we randomised people to very low-calorie diets, that's the shakes and things like that, versus putting, one of the surgeries that was done 15 years ago was to put a lap band around your stomach, which would limit how much people would eat. So we randomised people to lap bands or to very low-calorie diets and to look at the effect on sleep apnea. And of the 60 people who were randomized, 30 got lap bands, 30 got very low calorie diet. We were expecting all this sleep apnea to go away. Now, the average weight loss in this group was 28 kilograms, which probably is about, sorry, I'm on the kilogram thing. I'm thinking that's probably about 60 pounds, somewhere around there, 65 pounds. So there was a fairly good weight loss in the groups, but it did seem to be the first 10 kilograms or the first 22 pounds that seemed to have the biggest impact on the sleep apnea severity. And it didn't really matter how you lost the weight, both sides had the same impact. The scary bit was we had a couple of patients who lost 50 kilograms, so that was 120 pounds. Now, they had 120 pounds to lose, but their sleep apnea didn't change at all. So if you can see that, yes, weight loss is likely to help, but it may not help everybody. And it, the interesting thing for us was it wasn't, you know, you didn't have to lose all your excess weight. It could have been as little as little, but in these people, they were obese. So in these, so it could have been as little as 10 kilograms or 22 pounds that had quite a significant impact on the severity of their sleep apnea. So what, in summary, what that actually means is any weight loss is going to be good. It's going to help. And obviously, even if you're carrying a lot of weight, it might only be small amounts of weight still will improve your snoring or sleep apnea. But it is important once you've lost the weight that we retest you and check it just to make sure that the sleep apnea has gone away.
Right. Wonderful. Wonderful. And actually, you just hit on a topic that I was going to ask you about next, which is the testing part. And, you know, I know that there's the option for people to go into a sleep clinic and get hooked up to a polysomnography and get a whole exam that way in the office. And then there's these home sleep apnea tests. Do you have any thoughts or opinions on whether one is better than the other, or what people should be looking for, or questions they should be asking about them?
So, I suppose I do have, I do a lot of, in Australia, I run a home diagnostic service, so in my free time. So, I actually really like sleep studies at home. Now, the reason I like sleep studies at home is number one, they're easy. They're easier than going into a sleep laboratory. Now, I don't know if you do. I ask. I've had a sleep study. Have you ever had a sleep study?
I have. Yes.
Yeah. So when you go into a sleep laboratory and you go into hospital and you're wired up, it is probably the most difficult thing to get a decent night's sleep. And potentially, we're going to be treating you for that sleep disorder for a long time off that one night's sleep. So I like home sleep studies for a number of reasons. One, even though you do, you know, you have wires on, and depending what level of sleep test you're doing, and there are different levels of sleep studies, which we can go through in a second, but even wearing the wires, if you're sleeping in your own bed, you do tend to sleep a little bit better. And we did a questionnaire when I first started doing this, and we looked at several hundred patients, but about 70% of people said they were sleeping like it was like a normal night's sleep, even with the wires on, etc. So the fact is that sleeping in your own bed, you are going to sleep better. You're not worried about not sleeping. If you have different sleep habits, so you tend to be going to bed late or going to bed very early, in a sleep laboratory, you sort of have to go to bed around 10 to 11 p.m. and then wake at 6 because that's the way that the sleep laboratories are often staffed. So you're sort of stuck with their schedule rather than your schedule. So one, I think it's more comfortable sleeping in your own bed. Number two, it's more indicative of a normal night's sleep because you have your own normal sleep habits. So we get to see what you're really doing. I actually had somebody once go to bed at 4 a.m. and wake up at 7, and you know, we could see it off the sleep test because they weren't lying down before 4 a.m. and then wondering why they were tired only after being in bed for 3 hours. So you do wonder how they get to me before they actually realize this. But, you know, so we do get to see what people are really doing. And the other thing is that it does tend to be a bit cheaper doing the sleep tests at home. And then if it's not compatible with the results, what you would expect, or they're not compatible with symptoms, you can then go into a sleep study in hospital if necessary. And there are lots of us that need sleep studies. So it does make it a bit more accessible to people, and there aren't the long waiting lists such as going into hospital as well.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
I'm a big fan of the home study.
Right, right. Well, I mean, the waiting list thing is a big issue, because if you're trying to get into an office to do a sleep study, I know the waiting list can be very long, and now you're going months and months and months, and you're waiting, whereas you can simply, you know, in the right cases, do it at home. And, you know, so I've had the opportunity to do the full-blown sleep study in office, and I also got to test some of the home tests, just because of the work that I'm doing with this show. So it was really interesting. The home test was certainly much more convenient and much less invasive. Yeah, there's benefits to both. But I need to stop and take our second commercial break here. So I'm going to go ahead and do that, and we'll be right back on Sleep Science Today. Have you ever wondered why you can't sleep well? Well, there could be lots of different reasons. In order to figure it out, I wrote the book, Why Can't I Sleep Well? It includes 150 common sleep questions that are asked and answered, and I provide all of the supporting science and evidence to address each of the questions. I encourage you to get a copy of Why Can't I Sleep Well by Andrew Kolsky. It's available at www.sleepsciencetoday.com.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Okay, we are back on Sleep Science Today. I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky. We're talking to Dr. Linda Schachter. And I want to move into a different area now, because we haven't talked about this on this show at all, and that's the role of people in jobs where sleep is important, like transport workers, people driving buses, operating trains, airplanes, all these types of things. Can you tell us a little bit about what actually goes on? Are these people checked for sleep disorders, or do they find out after an accident happens? How does the industry work?
Well, nowadays, so thank goodness, we're starting to bring in screening for sleep disorders. Now, there's a couple of different ways of doing screening. So one is questionnaire-based. And there are several questionnaires that tell us if somebody has a higher risk of sleep apnea. And definitely during work medicals, these questionnaires are being used. And if you fulfill certain criteria, then it's suggested, well, you go off and have a sleep study. So that's number one. So that's in the person who comes to their work medical. If you do have an accident a near miss, so you haven't actually fully had an accident, but you've had a close miss and it's been supervised or noticed, then those patients are sent off as, or those people are sent off as well to be screened for sleep apnea. So there's a couple of different ways. One of the problems, and I suppose it's in these people who do these safety critical roles, they know that if they complain of being tired or sleepy, that they're going to be sent off for sleep tests. So some people In Australia anyway, we know that a lot of our transport drivers aren't the most honest when they fill out some of the questionnaires, particularly those about tiredness and sleepiness, because they know it's going to impact their job. They're going to have to go off and have a sleep test and be assessed. But I see it as a really good thing, is that we're hopefully going to be treating these people earlier and preventing complications and hopefully preventing any accidents. But it's definitely being brought in now that we're going to be screening these people, particularly in the safety critical roles.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wonder, you know, I was doing some reading about this, at least in the US, and how our laws work. And what I came across is that if you are like an airline pilot or a bus driver or something like that, and I forget exactly how the law was written, but basically, if you know that you have sleep apnea and you are prescribed a CPAP, for example, as your treatment for it, then you have to be able to prove that you are using the CPAP as prescribed in order to maintain your ability to operate the machine that you're operating. And so I think there's hesitation on some people's parts to be diagnosed, because if they do get diagnosed and get this machine, now they've got this extra work they have to do. So it's kind of that double-edged sword. You want them to get proper treatment, but they're afraid to because they don't want extra paperwork. Is it similar for you in Australia?
Absolutely. So if you've been diagnosed with... So we diagnose people, the severity of their sleep apnea is based on the number of times that you stop breathing or shallow breathe per hour of sleep. And if you have moderate to severe sleep apnea, so if you stop breathing pretty much over 15 times or shallow breathe over 15 times an hour, and over 30 times an hour is considered severe sleep apnea, then you do need to be treated. And definitely severe sleep apnea, you can't actually work in some of these safety critical roles unless you're actually treated. And the suggestion initially is that you try CPAP, which is continuous positive airway pressure. Now, I know that it has a bit of a bad rap, but realistically, the masks are better, the machines are better than they used to be. But it's basically pushing in air, splinting your airway open and allowing you to breathe when you sleep at night. And so if you do have sleep apnea and you've got disturbed sleep and tired or sleepy, the aim is you're going to sleep well, wake refreshed and not be tired or sleepy during the day. The other benefit is you can't really snore on a CPAP machine if it's adjusted appropriately for you. So as much as the whole idea of it sounds terrible, there are newer masks, they're more comfortable, the pressure delivery is better. So there's a lot of very good things about it. So people shouldn't be scared about it. But if you do have significant sleep apnea and it is causing you to be tired or sleepy or severe sleep apnea, then yes, if you're in a safety critical role, you do need to be treated before you can work in Australia.
Wow, okay. So if you have someone who's, for whatever reason, having trouble adjusting to a CPAP machine, or it's just not working for them the way they would like it to work, are there any alternatives?
Yeah, there are alternatives. So there are mandibular advancement devices or mandibular advancement splints. So they're mouth splints that actually, and the way they work is there's a top and a bottom component to the mouth splint, and basically what it does is it brings the lower jaw forward when you sleep at night, and so by doing that it increases the size of the upper airway and so will help treat the sleep apnea as well. So that's another option if people are intolerant or don't want to use nasal CPAP, so mandibular advancement splints. If people are intolerant to mandibular advancement splints, there are other options for treatment. So weight loss may be helpful, but that's obviously a long-term thing. That's not going to work very quickly. The other thing that we can do is there are tests that check if you're in a passive situation, can you stay awake? And these are called maintenance of wakefulness tests. So you sleep overnight in hospital, and then the next day you basically are in a dark, quiet room for 40 minutes, four times, and you've got to prove you can stay awake so that you're not at risk. So that's if you can't tolerate any treatment of sleep apnea, you've got to actually prove you can stay awake in boring situations, so you're not going to fall asleep if you're driving or doing safety critical work.
Right. Wow, that's interesting. I had not heard of that one before. So, okay. Well, let's shift gears here again for a second, because I want to make sure we cover this. What do you see as a practitioner? What do you envision sort of the future of sleep medicine to be like? Are there any new things coming online that you didn't expect to see before, or things you know that people are working on that you're hoping to see come online?
Okay, that's a really tricky question. Okay, so the future of sleep medicine, I mean, the scariest thing I think I'm seeing now, so if I go back 25 years to what I saw when I started sleep medicine, which was snoring, sleep apnea, pretty much that was the majority of what I saw. I saw a little bit of people with narcolepsy or sleepiness conditions. So, it was sort of, whereas now what I'm seeing is lots and lots of insomnia, lots and lots of anxiety affecting sleep. I suppose the changes that we're seeing are people are much more interested in their sleep, but also as a society, we're getting fatter, so there's more sleep apnea. We're getting more anxious, so there's more insomnia. And I suppose the other thing is our expectations. Now that we've realised sleep's important, we all want to be able to sleep perfectly. So I think the future of sleep medicine is it's going to be, I mean, I hate to say it, but lots of us have sleep problems. And as time progresses, more and more people are actually getting sleep problems. And it's all these, like I said, it's anxiety, it's sleep apnea. We're just seeing lots and lots. I mean, I don't tell people at dinner parties anymore what I do, because everyone snores and everyone has everyone's tired, and if it's a group of menopausal women, they've all got terrible sleep. So it does appear that sleep is just, becoming more and more of an issue for most of us, and and everyone's got different sleep issues.
Right. Well, and, I look at that as a good thing, meaning that it means that people are becoming aware of issues that they've had, they just didn't know they had them.
Yeah,
and, like you said, when you were first looking at or prior to you getting into sleep medicine, sleep wasn't even considered an issue. It was just sort of a side thing. But now people are recognizing that there are indeed actual sleep disorders, and there's treatments for them. And, they do impact us during the day. So, the kid who's at school who's falling asleep isn't necessarily a lazy kid. They might have a sleep disorder and you just haven't diagnosed it. So, same thing in the workplace, I had someone tell me the other day that we were talking about narcolepsy. And cataplexy. So narcolepsy is when you're kind of falling asleep during the day, and cataplexy is when your muscles just sort of freeze on you and you can kind of fall down. And they were going through the airport security checkpoint, and the person had narcolepsy. I guess they must have had cataplexy too, because they kind of fell down, almost like they passed out. And they were trying to tell the people there, I'm okay, I have, narcolepsy. But people didn't know anything about it, and so they were concerned that this was, some huge medical issue. So it's just educating people about it, and that's sort of the purpose of why we're here.
I've got to say, though, that if I was in a queue to go through the detector and somebody collapsed on the ground, and I know about cataplexy and I've seen it, I still would be thinking about other conditions before I'd be thinking cataplexy. So in that circumstance, and probably, yes, it is important that people are educated, but probably we should go to checking their pulse and blood pressure and a few things before we actually go, oh, well, it's just cataplexy. So,
right. I get you. It's just the fact that the person was saying and telling them, and nobody even had any frame of reference to understand what they were saying. So,
absolutely.
Yeah.
No, but look, I mean, sorry?
I was just going to say, it's good that we are even having this discussion, because that means that more people are becoming aware of these issues, and then they can look into things if they need to get more information.
If you're talking about interesting new things in sleep, I don't know. There's some great new research in narcolepsy talking about new things that are happening. And there are some new drugs. So the chemical that's missing in narcolepsy, depending where you come from in the world, is either called orexin or hypocretin. And it's basically what happens is that the cells that produce it get damaged. Now, you've got a predisposition, and then the thought process is a virus turns it on, and then these cells get destroyed and you don't have the chemical that wakes you up during the day. But there are some great new trials going on around the world, actually, to replace this chemical. And the studies are actually showing fantastic results. So, you know, hopefully within 5 to 10 years, this will actually be on the market, that we will be able to treat people with narcolepsy to actually replace the orexin or hypocretin, which is the chemical that's missing. So, and like I said, the data from these early studies is pretty phenomenal. So that's going to be a huge change within only a few years of how we treat narcolepsy, which is phenomenal, which is going to be great.
Wow. That's amazing. That's fantastic. And I'm sure that people in that community have got to be thrilled that, you know, these options are coming online. So, well, I do have to cut us off here, because we're actually at the end of our time. I appreciate you taking your time to educate us on all these different issues. There's so many things that people need to learn about related to their own sleep and their family members and others. So, Dr. Linda Schachter, thank you for joining us today on Sleep Science Today. If you're listening to this show and you want to keep up with what we're doing, you can go to sleepsciencetoday.com and sign up for our newsletter, and we'll keep you apprised of things that are going on. And if you happen to have sleep issues and you're looking for a free online sleep support group, you can go to sleepsupportgroup.com and sign up there. There's no charge for anything. We offer that group. Right now it's once a month, and we'll see how it goes, and maybe we'll expand it. So thank you for listening to Sleep Science Today. I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky. We will see you on the next episode.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Sleep Science Today and learning how to sleep better with your host, Andrew Kolsky, on UK Health Radio. For more information on how you can achieve better sleep, go to sleepsciencetoday.com. Remember, sleep science today and sleep better tonight.